We're throwing off the filters of tradition and culture to discover what the Bible really says about relationships. Relationships with God, with ourselves, and with others. Welcome to this episode of Relationship Truth Unfiltered. We're talking today about headship and submission and how people who misunderstand these topics, it can actually contribute to abuse in marriage. Leslie, can you explain?
Yeah, I've had a number of situations where that's exactly what happened. And so let me start by just asking a couple of questions. Does a husband, as the head of a home, have the right to control how his wife spends her free time, what she reads, what television program she watches, what movies she goes to, what clothes she wears, the friends she hangs out with, how much time she spends with her family of origin, what she buys, how she thinks, what she feels, the things she needs to work on or change for herself, or ultimately, who she should be? Is biblical headship synonymous with taking control over someone else's life and then forcing her to comply when she resists? And does biblical submission require a wife to always do what her husband says, even if she doesn't want to? Does it mean she has no choices of her own, that she can never say no without being labeled as rebellious, unsubmissive, or ungodly? This can be a very tricky issue because many good, godly people believe the Bible teaches headship and submission. But what do those definitions mean, and how are they played out in specific relationships can make a world of difference in how that marriage goes. So let me give you an example. Bill and Teresa came for counseling after an abusive incident. Bill was repentant. He said, "I know I shouldn't have done that. I lost my temper. I threw her cell phone in the sink and it was full of water and now it's broken. We'll buy her a new cell phone. I'm really sorry. I won't do it again." And so typical marriage counseling would say, "Okay, Teresa, Bill's sorry. He lost his temper. Forgive him. We're all better now, right?" But the real issue was much more insidious than that. Why did Bill throw Teresa's cell phone in the water? We have to unpack the story. So what happened here? Well, Bill said, "Teresa knows I hate when she talks on the phone when I'm home for dinner. We have very little time together and she's home all day. She works from home. I work a heavy job, a busy job. I get home. I want that time for us. And so I've told her I don't want her on the phone. I don't want her talking to her friends. I don't want her talking to her family. If she wants to talk to them, she has all day to talk to them." Now, mind you, Teresa works all day, but somehow she can find time to talk to these people if she wants to, in Bill's mind. So he's made this rule that she's not allowed to talk on the phone evenings or weekends. If she wants to talk on the phone, she can do it when he's not there. Evenings and weekends, our their time. That's Bill's rule. Teresa has submitted to that rule. She has told her family and friends, "Don't call me in the evenings. Don't call me on weekends. It upsets Bill. If you need to call me during the day." So everybody was complying with these rules, except for this night. What happened? So Teresa's phone is sitting on the kitchen table and she sees it ring and it's her sister's phone number. And she thinks, "Oh my gosh, my sister knows not to call me during dinner. There must be something wrong. Maybe my parents had a heart attack or got in a car crash," or you know how we start to think, worst case scenario. And so she says to Bill, "I'm going to answer this. There must be an emergency." Bill gives her a dirty look like, "You know the rules, Teresa." But Teresa, as an adult woman, needs to have the right to make a choice to answer her own phone, doesn't she? Teresa felt so. So she said, "Bill, I'm going to take this." She gets up. She goes off to the other room. She says to her sister, "What's wrong?" Her sister said, "Teresa, I know I'm not supposed to call you, but I'm in a terrible mess." And Teresa's sister was having a problem with her computer. Teresa was a computer IT expert. She needed it fixed for an important work project the next day. Teresa walked her through it. It took about 10 minutes. Teresa came back to the table, turned off her cell phone, sat down, and said to Bill, "I'm back. She was having a problem with her computer. I helped her fix it. No big deal." Bill said, "Give me your phone." She said, "No, I'm not going to give you my phone." And she grabbed her phone off the table. He said, "Give me your phone now." She said, "No, I'm not going to give you my phone." So here, is Teresa being rebellious and unsubmissive, or is Teresa resisting her husband's power over her as to her stewardship of her own phone? So then Bill grabs her phone out of her hand, pries her fingers apart, and throws the phone in the soapy water. Now, Bill readily agrees, I shouldn't have done that. But really, in his mind, it's Teresa's problem because she didn't obey him. So I think this is where it gets really tricky for Christian counselors, pastors, church leaders to discern what the real problem is. Was Teresa unsubmissive? Does she now need to forgive her husband for an abusive incident, but ultimately Bill's the head of the home, and if he wants to make these rules about Teresa's cell phone use, that's his prerogative as her leader, as her head, as her authority, and Teresa has no choice but to obey? This is a gross misunderstanding of biblical headship and submission. And unless we dig deeper in situations like that, we mislead husbands to believe that they do have power over someone in a controlling way. And we also mislead wives into thinking that they have no choice, no voice, that once they get married, they have lost their status as an adult to make adult decisions for themselves, that every decision they make has to be under the approval of their husband. And I don't think that's what the Bible teaches at all when it talks about headship or submission.
Doesn't the Bible teach he is the authority? And wouldn't it just be easier to kind of go with the flow and not make them mad? Doesn't this teaching lead to more marital fighting?
Well, yes and no. It depends on the way that the wife resists and the way the husband leads. So let's talk about headship first, because I remember when I was getting married, my pastor said to me, Leslie, you know, here I was 23 years old. I had a master's degree. My husband was 27. He had a master's degree. We were both educated. We were both adults, both believers. And all of a sudden he says, now, Leslie, you know, he has the final say in everything. And I'm like, really? Like all of a sudden I'm not an adult anymore. I don't get to decide anything for myself. He gets the final say in everything. I don't think that's what the Bible describes as leadership. In fact, Jesus was really clear about this with his disciples. He was in a patriarchal culture. The whole Bible was written in a patriarchal culture. And one of the things that the Bible was very clear about is that there are oppressors and there are the oppressed. All you have to do is read the first 10 Psalms. And it talks a lot about how God sees the oppressor, the one who bullies others, and the oppressed, those who are bullied by the bully. And God is always on the side of the bullied and always against the oppressor. So if that's how God's heart is, he would never set up a leadership structure where you have bullies and bullied, even in marriage. And so when Jesus was teaching his view of headship, leadership, we need leaders and leaders have power. But he's saying, hey guys, don't misuse your power as leaders. Don't misuse the authority that I'm going to give you as my leaders. In fact, let me show you how this works. And then he donned a towel and a basin and he washed all of their dirty feet. When Jesus was demonstrating headship to his very disciples, he was not saying, tell them to do this and tell them to do that, beat them up for this and tell them they better submit to you or you're going to put them in jail. He wasn't describing that as a form of godly leadership. He was demonstrating leadership by doing servant's work, by showing them you serve others, you care about others. This is what leaders do. This is what the heads do. They don't demand their own way. They don't get their own way. The Bible has a different word for that. It's called selfishness. And so when Jesus was teaching his disciples about leadership and about headship, he was specifically saying to them, don't do it like the world does it. Don't do it like the Gentiles do, who lord over others with their leadership and their power. Don't be the oppressor. Not so with you. If you want to be first, if you want to be a leader, if you want to be the head, if you want to be an authority, serve others. You get to serve first. That's the biblical definition of leadership. And the biblical definition of submission is that you have a choice, that you have a choice to submit. And all believers are called to submit to authority. All believers are called to submit to God. All believers are called to submit to one another. It's not just women and wives who are called to submit. Submission's a wonderful discipline to teach us that we don't have to get our way all the time. But submission is something that you do voluntarily, or it's not called biblical submission. If someone forces you to submit, it's called oppression. It's called oppression and bullying. And that is not God's design for marriage. God designed Adam and Eve to be mutual in partnership, not in a slave, master, child, parent relationship. And so when we see examples of headship being misused in the church to oppress and bully and squash a woman, that you have to be what I tell you to be, you have to do what I tell you to do, you're not free to flourish and blossom as God calls you to be, that's not healthy leadership or godly headship any more than squashing a child because you don't want them to grow up, squashing their talents and their abilities because you're threatened by their beauty and like Snow White, or you're threatened by their athletic abilities that you didn't have. And so you mock them and you make fun of them and you shame them for their intelligence and all that. You think you're so smart. Yeah. You think you know everything. You don't know nothing. And you shame them and you mock them. That's not godly parenting when you squash another person. And so if a child came to their youth group and said, you know, my mother won't let me, she's 13. My mother won't let me pick out my own clothes. My mother won't let me shower without her checking me to make sure I'm clean. My mother won't let me set my own alarm clock. She won't let me do my own homework. No counselor, pastor, or other adult would think that's healthy parenting. They wouldn't tell a child, well, God says you're to obey your parents, so do whatever they tell you to do. They would understand this is toxic to the growth of the child. This is undermining the child's growth. In the same way, we are all called to grow. We are all called to maturity. We are all called to be all that God called us to be. And marriage is supposed to enhance that for both, not to have one squash the other in order to get their way all the time. And I think that is a huge misapplication and misunderstanding of biblical headship and biblical submission, and it causes a ton of problems in marriage.
So Leslie, let me just give you an example and tell me how this would work. Let's say a woman wants to go on a girl's weekend and he doesn't want her to go. What does she say? How does she handle it?
Well, again, I think you can't just take one example and make a global, she should do this kind of statement. So if I were talking to her, I would say, is this a pattern in your relationship where you want to do something and your husband doesn't let you do this? And she might say, no, generally he does, but we haven't been able to spend much time together. And, you know, he's been traveling a lot and I've been really busy and he just wants me home and, you know, he wants to spend time with me. Then I would say, this might be a good opportunity for you to submit that, you know, you haven't spent much time together. He's been missing you. He's not generally trying to micromanage your life. He's not generally telling you you can't do something, but he's telling you right now, I don't really want you to go. I want you to be home with us and the family. We miss you. Then it might be something good to listen to. This is part of what couples do with each other. They listen. They hear the feedback of the other person. So if that's the general tone of the marriage, then I might say, maybe it's a good idea for you to submit to this one and just say, okay, no problem. But if the general tone is like Bill and Teresa's, that your husband's got all these rules and you're not allowed to go to retreats and you're not allowed to leave on the weekends, like a woman, I was working with a woman who was a physician. She's a doctor. She's capable of making very good decisions. And yet her husband did not let her make any decisions with their money, even though she made most of it. He did not let her make any decisions regarding being involved in church, being involved in a women's retreat, wanting to go out for lunch with friends. He used this headship, like, I want you to work because you bring lots of money into the home, but you're not allowed to do anything else. And here's this intelligent woman who's making very capable decisions about other people's life and their health, and yet she's not allowed to make a decision for herself about whether to go to a women's retreat. And that was the overall pattern of their relationship. Her husband was so threatened by her independence and her abilities that he squashed them wherever he could, except for in the money department, because she could bring in a lot of money, but he didn't want her to do anything else. He's crippling her in order to continue to cripple him. He's insecure. He's not willing to grow into the man that God called him to be. He's feeling threatened by her strength. And so I have to squash her strength in order for me not to feel threatened. That's not a win-win for either one of them. So if that's the kind of situation you're in and your husband's regularly diminishing your ability to connect with other women and have a life of your own and have friends, then you might need to say something completely different. As, you know, I really need this women's retreat. It's really good for me. I really need to spend time with the Lord and I need some downtime away from family responsibilities. And I know that you don't want me to go, but I think I need to go and I'm going to go. And so make a decision for yourself, the same as you might do if you were having a toothache and your husband said, I don't think you should go to the dentist. We don't really have the money. You do have the money, but he doesn't want to spend the money. I don't think you should go to the, it's probably not that bad. It'll probably go away. And you're like, no, I have a toothache and I need to go to the dentist. You would steward your teeth, I hope, or you would steward your health, and you would make that decision even if he told you not to, because that is what God calls you to do, is steward your life and your growth. He's not asking your husband to be your parent. He's not asking your husband to take over your life. You're to steward your life. For example, who's to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ? Your husband or you? Who's to guard your heart above all else, for it is the wellspring of life? Your husband or you? Who's to put off the old and put on the new in Ephesians? You. And so if you abdicate stewardship for your life and you give him control over your life, you are not going to grow. You're going to be diminished. And God calls us all. It is God's will for you to grow and live a holy life, even if you're married. And husbands don't get the right to squash that growth under the guise of headship.
Are you living with someone who has some real problems? It has a huge impact on everything, doesn't it? Especially you. Have you done everything in your power to get him to see what he's doing and nothing changes? And let me guess, the church's advice is to suck it up and submit, forgive, sacrifice yourself. But all that's doing is making him more of a monster and you more of a resentful victim. Friend, there are real biblical answers to what you're going through. And Leslie, she'll be sharing them in a free webinar on August 17th at 12 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Eastern. The title of the webinar, I'm Not Okay When You're Not Okay, Defining My Problem, Your Problem, and Our Problem. Leslie will even answer your questions live. You're listening to this podcast because you know the kind of value there is in Leslie's teaching. Don't miss this webinar. Go to leslievernick.com/okay to register. That's leslievernick.com/okay. We'll see you there.
So, how should a woman explain this new understanding to a man who believes that he is the final authority?
Slowly and respectfully.
Exactly.
So this is going to be a big change for them, right? And so I think it's okay. Just like if you learn a new idea about, wow, I realize that cooking fried chicken 3 times a week is not good for our arteries. And he really likes fried chicken. And you might say, hey, I've come under the conviction that this is really unhealthy. And I'm just not willing to keep cooking fried chicken. Your cholesterol's high, my cholesterol's high. I'm going to start doing it differently, right? In the same way that you might do that way, and he doesn't like it, are you going to still feed him? I mean, would you just keep buying him alcohol because he wants it? No. If you're a relatively healthy person, you're going to say, if you want fried chicken, go buy your own fried chicken, but I'm not making it anymore because it's not healthy. And so in the same way, you might say to him, you know, I know that you have these convictions about these things, and I have come to the decision that that is not what the Bible teaches. If you can show me anywhere in the Bible that it says that you have the right to make all my personal decisions about who I hang out with and what I do with my time and energy, I'll be happy to look at that. But I don't think that's what headship teaches. I don't think that's what Jesus taught. If you want me to show you where I come up with that, I'd be happy to do that. But I don't believe that anymore. And here's where you're starting to become a helpmate instead of a robot. You know, God calls us to be helpmates for one another. And my husband, he reads all my blogs before I send them out. And he'll say, well, I don't agree with that. I think you're being too harsh, or I'm not sure you're quite biblical on that. I appreciate that because I don't know everything about everything. My staff will look at that and say, oh, I'm not sure about that. So people give us feedback about ourselves that help us to grow and mature. Our job as wives isn't to just be objects or clones or yes people to our husbands and then let them continue blindly on their way like the emperor's new clothes. Our job as helpmates to our husband is to tell them the truth. It says in Hebrews 3:13, for example, let us encourage one another day after day, lest any one of us become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So if you believe your husband's theologically off in something, or you don't agree with what he believes in the Bible, speak up and say, I don't see it that way anymore. If you want me to show you why, I can be happy to show you why. Or if you want to show me, I'm happy to have that dialogue with you, but I don't believe that you get to decide for me who my friends are or how I spend all my free time. And I need to spend some time with other women at a women's retreat. That's what I need right now. And so I don't believe that submission or headship means that you get to make that decision for me.
So for a lot of women, if they start doing this, they are going to have a price to pay. When she comes home from that women's retreat, she may get the silent treatment, she might get snide comments, or even worse. How should we handle this?
So one of the hallmarks of an abusive relationship, and we've talked about this in other podcasts, is the desire to control you. Again, headship doesn't mean he gets to control you. So if you start asserting yourself and controlling yourself, doesn't mean you don't respect him. It doesn't mean that you don't bend at times to things he might want you to do. That's fine. That's part of living together, even with a roommate, that they want to have a cleaner room than you do. And you bend with that and you clean up after yourself a little bit better than you might have if you just live all alone. That's what you do with people that you live with. You respect their feelings and they respect yours. But when you live with someone who feels that they have the right to micromanage your life, including your thoughts and feelings, don't feel that. Don't give me that look. You're not allowed to have your own opinion. You have to think how I think. You have to want what I want. You have to be who I call you to be, not what God calls you to be. And they won't be that direct with it usually. But as you start asserting yourself and they start punishing you for that, that's a major red flag for you that you are in a very unhealthy marriage, perhaps an abusive marriage, because he's feeling he has the right to control who you are, what you do, what you think, what you feel. And if you don't comply, you're punished. That's an oppressed relationship, not a healthy marriage. And I get it. I get it that it makes it more tense for you. And so here's where you're going to have to put your brave on as a wife and decide, am I going to be a peacekeeper and a peace faker, a peace at any price woman who's willing to just shrivel up and die as a person in order to keep the peace in my marriage? Is that what God's calling me to do? Or is he calling me to put my brave on and speak the truth in love? To resist oppression in a God-honoring way. And I think that's what he's calling us to do. If we think about some of the examples in the Old Testament, Abigail, she was married to a foolish man who told his servants that he wasn't going to feed David and his men out of stupidity. And David, out of stupidity, got enraged and decided he was going to kill everybody in Nabal's household in 1 Samuel, I think, 19. All the servants go running to Abigail and saying, Abigail, Abigail, what do we do? David's coming to kill everybody in our household. So if we were to take the traditional biblical point of view, we would say Abigail should just say, well, it's in the Lord's hands. I guess I just have to submit to my husband and everything because he made that decision. But that's not what she did. Her story is in the Bible. She said, no way, Jose, let's get all the food together and I'm going to go out and approach David. She had no idea what was going to happen next. So she did rock the boat, just like we talked about, Julie, that sometimes it does make things worse. And she knew it was going to make things worse. She didn't just keep the peace at the peril of everybody's life. She said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go approach David. She didn't know if David was going to kill her right there, not even her own husband, but David was so angry. But she did the next right thing. That's why it's so important that women who are in these situations become a God-centered woman, not a husband-centered woman. Your husband doesn't get to decide for you what you do. God decides for you what you do. And so she knew the right thing to do and she did it. And she could have been killed. She didn't know if David was going to kill her. And then if David didn't kill her, her husband might have killed her when she got home and told him what she did. And the end of the story is her husband died. And she ended up marrying David. Now, we don't always know the outcome because another woman in the Old Testament, Vashti, she was a queen before Queen Esther in the book of Esther. And her husband wanted her to come and dance before his drunken friends in the orgy. And she said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to degrade myself and let you and your friends sexually abuse me with your eyes. I'm not going to do that. And the king was so flabbergasted by what she did. He didn't know what to do, but his advisors said, hey, she's going to be a bad example to every other woman that we try to control and tell what to do. If you let her get away with this, all of our wives are going to resist our control over them. And so he punished Vashti by taking away her queenship and banishing her from the kingdom. So sometimes it costs you, yes. It may cost you things to say no. But here's where you have to decide what God's calling you to be. Is he calling you to be a woman of strength and dignity? Or is he calling you to be a passive pawn of an abusive oppressor? I can't make that decision for you, but I think the Bible's really clear what he calls you to be. And so that requires you to not fix your husband and not fix your marriage, but for you to get strong enough to be able to say no in the right way. You know, one of the things that God has given us that is an essential freedom to be a human being is the right to say no. That we have the freedom to say no. When he created Adam and Eve, he gave them the ability to say no. And they did say no to him. We're not going to listen to you. And there are consequences to saying no sometimes. And there are consequences to saying the wrong yes too. And so you have to discern that about what God is calling you to do. But this is relationship truth unfiltered. So I'm going to tell you the truth, that if you keep feeding the idea that you have no rights and your husband has the right to control and manage you as if you were a slave or a child, nothing's going to change. And you're going to become more of a slave and a child. And you're going to become less the woman that God called you to be. And he's going to be less the man that God called him to be.
Leslie, what does healthy mutual decision-making look like? Because so many of our listeners have no clue. They've just given in when they have two different ideas for vacation. They just defer to whatever the husband says. What is it supposed to look like?
It looks like different things for different people. But I think the first thing it looks like is let's put our cards on the table about what we really want. So I'm just going to make some minor decisions. Where do you want to go for dinner? Where do I want to go? I don't really care. I don't have a taste for anything specific tonight. What do you want to go to? I really have a taste for steak. Okay, let's go for steak. But what if I said, oh, I'm so hungry for seafood. And my husband says, well, I'm hungry for steak. Well, is there a place we could go for seafood and steak? Or does he say, oh no, I just want to go for steak. So we're going to go to the place I want to go and there's no seafood there. Do you know what I'm saying? That in a healthy relationship, you both state what you want. I want to go to the beach. I want to go to the mountains. Is there a place that has beach and mountains so we can hike and swim? Can we afford that? Or maybe we can go to the mountains this year and the beach next year. So we work together to make it a win-win solution. If we both feel strongly about something, sometimes one of us doesn't feel strongly about something, or maybe one of you don't know that much about something. For example, sometimes my husband will ask me about buying a certain kind of car. I'm like, I don't really care. I don't really care what kind of car we buy. I'm not into cars. As long as it drives and it has air conditioning. And when I lived in the cold, heated seats, I'm good. And buttons that push down for the lock. That's all I cared about, you know? And so I don't care what kind of car we have. I mean, I want to look at it before we actually buy it, but I don't want to even go looking for cars. If we can afford it, give me three choices and I can look at those. And so I think it depends on whether it's important to you, whether you trust the other person, whether you have a general voice and choice in decision-making. And so there's other decisions that my husband would defer to me about because I'm much better at it. So maybe in parenting kinds of things and relationship things, he might say, well, what do you think? I'm not sure what to do. And I'll say, I think we should do this. And he'll say, okay, because I'm better at those things. He's better at managing investments. I'm better at deciding decorating. I don't give him a lot of choices with decorating.
Say, absolutely not.
We're not doing that. That's not going to work.
Could have a big camo living room.
That's right. So, but in a healthy marriage, you have those discussions and no one takes offense. You're able to be you. And this is important for healthy relationships, that you have the freedom to be you. I don't like that. I do like that. This is what I'm good at. I know more than this about this. Instead of just, I'm a nobody, I'm an empty object, and all I am is to serve and service you. That's like my cell phone. My cell phone doesn't have an opinion of its own. It just does what I want. Is that the idea of relationship? When we look at relationships in the Bible, it's nothing like that between God and people or people with one another. And so if you're just an object to use, a wife, a mom, a maid, a laundress, a sex object, don't kid yourself. That is not a healthy, happy relationship at all. And it doesn't describe the biblical picture of marriage.
When I got married, I married a police officer and he was a single man. He owned his own home, had for several years, and he was very used to coming home and just throwing his gun on the nightstand and going to sleep. When we got married, that was fine with me. I wasn't really comfortable around guns, so I just stayed away from it. But when we had our first child, I changed my point of view completely. And I would ask him, please, can you get a gun safe? And he did not want to because he wanted to have easy access to his gun in case there was an intruder. And this was an ongoing discussion or argument between us, especially as the baby began to become more mobile. So he would put it up high, and that was what he said, I'll put it up on top of this shelf or this dresser or whatever. And I kept telling him I wasn't comfortable and that wasn't good enough for me, but I deferred to him. Until one night, I was in the kitchen cooking dinner. Nicole was probably 18 months old, and I looked through the doorway and I saw her sucking on the nozzle of his loaded gun, and the safety was off.
Ugh.
And Leslie, I can tell you, I will never, ever unsee that image in my mind. He had simply forgotten, and old habits die hard. He had set his gun on the coffee table. He just forgot to put it up high. Now, I don't even want to think about what could have happened, but I will tell you what did happen. I screamed. I ran to that baby. I picked her up. And he came in the room because he heard me scream. I pointed my finger at his face and I said, I now win this argument. This gun goes in a gun safe, a locked gun safe today, or we leave immediately. And that was the deal. I was not discussing it anymore. And I will tell you, to his credit, he sat down on that coffee table and cried. And he has never, we bought a gun safe that day. But there are times when we do, as women, have to stand our ground. So Leslie, for those of us who are really struggling with that, would you please pray for us?
Great story, Julie. And it is hard. The safety and sanity of our family is a high priority to mamas and hopefully papas, but sometimes not. But it's certainly a high priority to God. And so you were right to stand up for your kid and yourself. And I'm grateful that your husband respected your stand and submitted to you, because that is the godly order, submit one to another. Father God, I just pray that you would help us understand headship. Some of us are heads. We're parents. We're the heads of our children. We're heads of PTAs, or we're teachers. We have power over others. We're the heads of companies. But Lord, when we have power, whether we're the pastor, whether we're the parent, whether we're the husband, you very clearly warn us not to misuse our power for selfish purposes, just to get our ego stroked, just to get our way, just to get everything that we want, and use people as objects and then throw them away. Father, nobody has the right answers in everything. So to completely defer to one person without any feedback is foolishness. You tell us that. Kings listen to their advisors. Good leaders listen to the feedback of others. And so to call headship unquestioning obedience to the authority of another without any voice or choice is not biblical. Lord, help women and men and husbands and wives and pastors and Bible teachers to teach it correctly, Lord, that there would be less opportunity to misuse the Bible to oppress others in families, and to turn children into people who don't like God and don't like his ways because they see them as oppressive and abusive, which is the farthest thing from your heart. Lord, help us to do the right things and stand up for what's right, even when it's scary and hard. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening to Relationship Truth Unfiltered. Remember to sign up for Leslie's free webinar on August 17th. Even if you can't make it, there will be a replay sent to those who register. Just go to leslievernick.com/OK. Until next time, may God bless your relationships with him, with yourself, and with others.